Welcome to the Red Hills Church Podcast. To learn more about Red Hills Church, like groups, gathering times, or other resources, visit us online at redhills.church. That's redhills.church. This message is by Tony Scarsello.
The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, his horsemen and his army, chased after them and caught up with them as they camped by the sea beside Pi Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. They said to Moses,
"Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Isn't this what we told you in Egypt? Leave us alone so that you may serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than die in the wilderness."
But Moses said to the people,
"Do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the Lord's salvation that he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you must be quiet."
The Lord said to Moses,
"As for you, lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground."
And the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with the waters like a wall to them on their right and on their left.
This is the word of the Lord.
How is everybody doing this morning? Good, good. It's great. Happy to see you. It is April 26, 2019. I'm sitting in a full movie theater for a movie that I bought tickets for 5 months in advance. This is the most anticipated movie of the decade, and I think we have a picture of it. It is Avengers Endgame. This is the culmination of almost a little over 10 years of storytelling in a thing that cinematic history has never seen before, where starting with Iron Man, eventually this giant universe built up, and all of a sudden all of those stories were about to come together and clash in this moment with Avengers Endgame. And I don't know if any of you saw it in the movie theater that opening weekend, but I have never been a part of a movie theater crowd that was so electric. You would have thought that the characters on screen could hear the audience cheering and clapping and laughing. My father-in-law was like sitting by me, and I won't spoil the ending in case you're one of the three people who hasn't seen this movie, but he's sitting by me and he's like weeping so hard that the little kid on the other side of him is like, "Daddy, is that old man okay?" Like, it was so, like, it was like a dynamic movie experience. And if you've seen Avengers Endgame, you know that at the end, and if you haven't seen it, I'm sorry that you thought you were too cool to watch it then. I'm going to spoil a little bit now. At the end of Avengers Endgame, Captain America is facing off against Thanos, right? He's doing his best to protect the universe, and all of a sudden, like, Thanos' army is piling up behind him, and it's just Captain America versus all of Thanos' army. And Captain America straps his shield to his arm, and it's broken from Thanos destroying it, and you know that this man is going to die by himself fighting this entire army. And it seems like all hope is lost, and then all of a sudden, you hear this, like, glitching noise. And then you hear, like, "Cap" on your left. And boom, like, we have a shot right there. All of a sudden, all the Avengers, like, start showing up through these, like, gold circle things that I'm so nerding out. Gold circle things like Doctor Strange's dudes do. And they all show up. And when I tell you that my movie theater just erupted in applause with people clapping, it was insane. It was like this giant sudden shift in the story where this dramatic, seemingly hopeless moment met this beautiful, beautiful moment where all of a sudden everything came together and you knew, like, okay, our heroes are going to be okay. They're going to save the world. A couple weeks ago, over Father's Day weekend, I took my dad, my father-in-law, to the Mariners and Cleveland Guardians game, and it was fun. And the first couple innings of the game, the Mariners score two runs right off the bat, and then we have like four innings of no scores at all. It just gets really, really boring. It starts to feel like a waste of time. And then in the fifth, sixth, and seventh inning, all of a sudden the Guardians get a run, get a run, get a run. And then we get to the ninth inning, and the score is 3 Guardians, 2 Mariners. And at the bottom of the ninth, with just like 2 plays left, the Mariners get the final few runs. And at the very, very last minute, they clutch the win. And it was so satisfying because I was there with my brother-in-law, who's a Cleveland Guardians fan. And And Cleveland Guardians fans are so smug. Like, any Cleveland fan you've met, like, they're so smug. And, like, he was just, like, so, like, sorry if you're a Cleveland fan in here, know thyself. But, like, he was just, like, rubbing it in our faces. He was talking about, we're a second-half team, blah, blah, blah. And we get to that last inning, that last run, the score's tied up. And, like, everybody in the stand is standing up. And, like, there are these people who I had never met before, and they're literally leaning on my shoulders, just watching. And when the Mariners get that last run for a seemingly inconsequential game, given the context of the season, people just erupted. And it was amazing. And there's a word for this that J.R.R. Tolkien used to describe. He made up a word to describe moments like this because he didn't feel like that our vocabulary had enough words to describe this. And he calls it a eucatastrophe. A eucatastrophe or a good catastrophe. And the way he defines it is a eucatastrophe is a sudden happy turn in a story, piercing you with joy and bringing you to tears. He talks about how in The Lord of the Rings, and especially in like the Two Towers, if you've seen The Lord of the Rings, at the end it seems like our heroes are lost. And all of a sudden Gandalf shows up with a whole army to save our heroes from the orcs. Or at the very end of The Lord of the Rings when Frodo fails to throw the ring into Mount Doom, and it seems like, oh my gosh, all of this was for nothing, and then Gollum comes and chops off his finger and gets pushed into the volcano. It's pretty sick. A eucatastrophe. We experience eucatastrophes in our lives too. This is when financing unexpectedly comes through, when you were so strapped for cash, you thought you were going to lose your home. This is the sudden healing after what you thought was a fatal diagnosis. This is the restoration of a marriage that you thought was for sure headed to divorce. This is the long prayed for prodigal son or daughter coming back home. And of course, the most important eucatastrophe in history is the resurrection itself. When all hope seemed lost, when the world was at its darkest, when it seemed like there was no way to undo the bad things that have been done, Jesus resurrects and a eucatastrophe happens. And eucatastrophe seems like the best word to describe what's going on here with our story in Exodus 14. Moses and Israel are caught between the raging sea and the might of Egypt's army. Hope seems lost, but then the most unexpected thing happens. And as we talk about this, it's easy to read this passage and think about the story and really just focus on the parting of the Red Sea's moment. And that is a big deal. I don't want to downplay the parting of the Red Sea's. But we need to understand that this is not just a story of rescue. This is a story of crisis. This is a story of doubt and disappointment and pain. Before the Red Seas are parted, it's kind of ugly seeing what comes out of the nation of Israel before God shows up in this dramatic way. Eucatastrophes do not happen without a catastrophe happening first. And before we get the rescue, we have to be really, really honest about what it is we need rescuing from. So I'm going to pray real quick. Lord, I just ask that you would open our hearts and our minds to receive wisdom from you, to receive rescue from you. Lord, would you expand our capacity to love you well and to love others well? And God, especially for those who are here, and they feel like they're in their crisis moment. Lord, would you just minister something special to them this morning? And we love you in your name. Amen. In 2025, the CDC reported that 42% of adults reported symptoms of anxiety and depression, and that was up 14% from 2019. Among young adults 18 to 24, that number was 57%. Teenagers between 11 and 18 years old were 38% more likely to experience depression and anxiety disorders than they were in 2010 when I was in high school. In 2023, the U.S. Surgeon General Advisory released a declaration calling the youth in a mental health crisis, citing skyrocketing levels of loneliness, depression, and suicidal ideation. As of 2022, suicide became the second leading cause of death among people between the ages of 10 and 34. Second leading cause of death. The frequency at which I am receiving phone calls from friends of mine who work in youth ministry or in public school systems asking me to pray for students who have attempted suicide or to pray for the families for the students who did commit suicide is overwhelming. It's beyond disturbing. Emergency room visits for self-harm have increased among teens 88%. From 2011 to 2025. Let me ask you this real quick. Church, are you regularly praying for Pastor James and Pastor Kim? Are you regularly praying for the people who are investing in the youngest, most vulnerable people in our church? Because they're on the front lines of what sociologists and psychologists have no idea what to do with. So can I just pause for a moment and just invite you, as you go throughout your week, as you think to pray for people, pray for Kim and her volunteers and James and his volunteers and our interns who are investing in one of the places where it seems like the enemy is taking ground furiously. In 2023, the Surgeon General's reported that over half of Americans feel lonely most of the time. And in that same report, they revealed that loneliness has the same physical impact as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. The crisis of mental health comes on the tails of another crisis, though. It comes on the tails of a crisis of meaning and purpose. The Harvard Human Flourishing Program reported that while financial well-being and physical health have remained stable, or maybe even improved, the metric of meaning and life continues to steadily decline among people. While we might be financially getting wealthier, buying nicer houses, having more options for nicer cars, getting higher paying jobs, and while medicine is like just kind of cutting edge right now, and there's treatments for all sorts of things that we never thought we would have treatments for, people are feeling less meaning and purpose in their life than they've been feeling in a long time. Nearly 60% of Gen Z says they often lack meaning and purpose in their life. And this isn't just in the U.S. this is happening. For a long time, countries like the U.K. and Sweden and Switzerland and all of those places, and then they were kind of treated as like these secular utopias who kind of threw away the trappings of religion and embraced a humanistic worldview. And it was often, there was a story that was touted about these places that would say, look, if you just get rid of the shame of religion and you just allow people to be their true, authentic selves, all of a sudden they're going to be happier and healthier. But what we're seeing across the pond in the UK Office of National Statistics is they're reporting higher use of antidepressant use and declines in life satisfaction than they've ever seen. In nations like Sweden, higher rates of youth suicide and loneliness every single year. And this challenges the popular myths that the popular myth that secular prosperity equals human rights and flourishing. But before the crisis of mental health, before the crisis of meaning and purpose, there was another crisis that came before these things that paved the way, I think, for these other things, and that is the crisis of faith. Directly preceding this unprecedented moment of despair in America, we saw the decline of religious affiliation and meaning. In 2020, for the first time, Gallup reported that in U.S. history that less than 50% of Americans claimed membership of a church, synagogue, or mosque. And if you think that's just COVID, everybody stopped going to church during COVID in 2020, they redid that survey in 2023, and it was still resting at about 47%. Pew Research discovered, they did a poll and they discovered that the religious nuns, which is not like nuns with habits and black stuff, but religiously unaffiliated, I don't claim any religion, they now make up 30% of the U.S. population. And the belief is that if trends continue by 2070, Christianity will become the minority faith in America, and the religious nuns will become by far the majority. Now, while many faith institutions have gone the way of Kodak video and Blockbuster video and cultural relevance, our culture has been drowning from the gap this faith has left. I do not believe it is an accident. The right is we are losing our grip, our society is losing its grip on faith and hope and peace and the story of a redeeming God and a renewing Savior, that at the same time as that starts to go, all of a sudden a crisis of meaning and a crisis of mental health happens right on the other side of it. And of course, I'm not saying that Christians are immune from depression and mental illness, and I'm certainly not saying that only secular people are the people who get that, but I am saying that without the guiding light of a redeeming God, all secularism has to offer us is to maximize pleasure and minimize pain and nothing else. And what we're seeing is that this is a weak story that does not have the resources to deliver and rescue a people in crisis. The crisis continues to rise. How is our attempt at governing ourselves without King Jesus going? How is our attempt at this going? And I don't start this off to raise the alarm about the next generation of people. I don't start this off to make us afraid about our loved ones. I start off talking about these statistics because for a lot of people in this room, these numbers aren't just numbers and a statistic. These numbers tell a story, and it's their story. There are people in this room right now who feel that suffering crisis, who feel the ache of mental anguish, who feel the grief and loss, who feel a lack of purpose and meaning. There are people in this room who, when they read this story and they see the nation of Israel caught between the raging sea and the army of Egypt on the other side, they relate to that feeling of being trapped. They relate to that feeling of like wondering what God is up to. They understand what it's like to be completely confused and in total need of rescue. There are people here for whom this story is all too familiar. Last week, Pastor Lane did an amazing job. And if you haven't heard the sermon from last week, go check out the podcast or watch it on YouTube. It was really good. But he did a great job teaching about Israel leaving Egypt slavery, and almost immediately after Israel is freed, danger returns. Israel is by the Red Sea, and God tells Israel that Pharaoh's heart is going to be hardened, that he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and that the Egyptians are going to give chase. And all of a sudden, the Israelites are freaking out. They feel like they're in a trap. They feel like God led them somewhere just to kill them. And how many of you guys can relate to this? How many of you guys can relate to thinking that you were faithfully following God's calling? You thought you were doing everything that you were supposed to do. You did the right thing, only to feel like you have been led directly into danger. Am I the only one who relates to this? Oh, so we're all liars. Okay, cool. So how many of you guys relate to that feeling of you prayed over your kids over and over and you thought you did the right things and they still left the faith? How many of you guys relate to that feeling of you thought your marriage, you did everything right, you married the right person, you prayed over that person, and all of a sudden the marriage fell apart. The job ended. The diagnosis still came, or the unjust person won out. You see, it's easy to read a story about this and think this, with the gift of hindsight, think this is just a story about a rescue. But before this is a story about a rescue, it is a story about profound confusion and disappointment. Before we can't just skip to the Red Sea parting. We have to have a moment where we sit in the tension of sometimes God calls us to a thing, sometimes we are led to a place, and for a little while, that place feels absolutely confusing and devastating. Israel thought they were done struggling, and then Pharaoh changes his mind about releasing the Israelites, and he chases after them. It's interesting to note, real quick, how difficult it is for unjust rulers to release control over the people they exploit. Can we just like stop and think about that? Egypt is in a moment right now, through the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. We're now, and by the way, like we get caught up on this as like, it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. What does that mean? But like seven times before that, it says Pharaoh hardened his own heart. So at a certain point, God just gives us what we want. If you want to have a hard heart, you're going to have a hard heart. Pharaoh's heart is hard. And all of a sudden, he's realizing there's a legitimate economic panic to this nation when all of the slaves are gone. Think about that. He's facing economic collapse. Slavery is good business for powerful and elite people. Watch what power brokers in society are willing to do when money is on the line. Watch what morals are willing to be betrayed when the bottom line is at stake. We would do well to remember this as citizens of the most prosperous nation on the planet. As followers of Jesus, when we learn that our money and our might is earned from the sweat and suffering of vulnerable people, we're at an impasse. As followers of Jesus, we're forced to make a choice. Do we do the right thing, or do we cruelly cling to our comfort, regardless of who it exploits in the process? For those of us who hold power, whether it's as an employer or a manager or organizational leadership or even as a parent, once you start wielding power unjustly, it is very, very hard to stop. Pharaoh had plenty of opportunities to cooperate with Yahweh, to release Israel, and instead of doing that, he clings to what is cruel and evil, and the cruel economy of empire will not allow the image of God to be honored as long as there is money to be made and pride to be preserved. So now Israel has this powerful army attacking them, and they're attacking them full on speed, and there's a raging ocean on the other side, and Israel is totally in panic mode. They do not understand why God would lead them to this. I think it's kind of funny where they're like, hey, like there's plenty of graveyards in Egypt. God didn't have to lead us out here to kill us. If like this was the plan, he could have just killed us there. We told you to leave us there. It's amazing because Israel now is like in this moment of crisis. And isn't it fascinating that after seeing God do 10 plagues, like God do crazy stuff, sending frogs and boils and raining frogs? We skipped out. I was not here when we talked about that. Raining frogs, turning water into blood. Like Israel saw crazy stuff, like R-rated movie stuff. And now they're here, and you think rationally, you'd be like, well, surely the 11th plague is going to come or something, right? Like something, God is going to do something. But isn't it amazing how when anxiety hits us, when we're in crisis, one of the first things we do is we forget about the presence of God. Have you noticed that in your own life? When you experience crisis or you experience anxiety, usually the first thing I do is not, well, let's turn to prayer. Let's just sit at the feet of Jesus and wait for the solution. When I feel pressed, when I feel the pressure is on, my resort is to lean on my own resourcefulness, to hustle and to try and make a thing happen. And when I can't make a thing happen, when Israel cannot deliver themselves from Egypt or make the raging seas part themselves, when they have no options, crisis and anger and doubt is what comes out of them. I call this deistic amnesia. Everybody say deistic amnesia. Deistic amnesia. It's like something scary happens, we all of a sudden we forget, like that there's a God who loves and who is there. So it shows two things. The first thing it shows us is that anxiety makes us forget the presence of God. But the second thing that it shows us is that crisis exposes our core beliefs when we're out of options. Crisis exposes our core beliefs when we're out of options. There's a sociologist by the name of Robert Bella, and he says that every person has two areas of beliefs. They have core beliefs and they have conscious beliefs. And he says that conscious beliefs are the things we choose to believe. I choose to believe that Jesus rose from the dead and died for my sins. I choose to believe that when my wife says she loves me, she's not like secretly harboring all this hatred and bitterness towards me. I choose to believe that any number of things, that this political candidate is the right choice. Conscious decisions are not usually things that happen to us. It's usually something that we make an assent to believe. But a core belief, as opposed to a conscious belief, is stuff we can't help but believe, even if we don't want to. And oftentimes, core beliefs are formed from a lot of trauma and a lot of pain. And in this story, Israel's core beliefs are coming out. Yes, it's true. They have seen Yahweh do amazing things. But we're talking about a span of a few weeks versus centuries of slavery and abuse and oppression. And I don't know about you, but my brain does not rewire that quickly. It takes a long time to get those traumatic wirings in my brain to change up. Israel's core belief is coming out, and what their core belief is that ultimately, at the end of the day, we are always slaves, and no one is looking out for us. Rescue is not coming. Israel is fine trucking along until there's nothing left for them to do, and then they're pressed, and what comes out is what they actually believe about things. And in this story, and through the miracles in the book of Exodus, God is healing and redeeming their core beliefs. You ever think about that? That the miracles are not just to liberate them. And the parting, God can do anything. He could just like zap, he could not harden Pharaoh's heart. He can change Pharaoh's mind. He can put a giant wall in between Egypt and Israel and make it to where Israel never sees the Egyptians coming to them. God could have handled this in any number of ways where this moment would not have felt like a crisis. But God chooses to allow them to experience this crisis because it's only in crisis that our core beliefs are exposed, and it's only once our core beliefs are exposed that we can open them to the presence of God and allow him to heal them. So friends, if you're here and you feel crisis, or you experience something poking at traumatic memories or triggering things that have happened to you, the invitation is not just to hide or run away or distract yourself or even just to complain a lot. The invitation is to stop and allow the Lord to heal those core beliefs and change our core beliefs until we're at our very instinct, at the core of our souls, we instinctually believe that we do have a rescuer and that we do have a redeemer and that help is always coming. Israel is in panic and doubt. But before we're too quick to cast stones at Israel, it's easy to stand back in judgment of Israel, but I'll guarantee you that every single person, no matter how holy they are, who's experienced crisis, relates to this moment right now. I'll bet you even Pastor Kim Lopez relates to this moment right now, where you go like, this is insane. This is scary. I have no idea how I'm going to get out of this. You don't even have the wherewithal to think to stop and pray. And if you haven't experienced that, it's coming for you. It comes for all of us. I hate to laugh at it, but it is coming for you. It's going to happen. And when it happens, it is humbling and it exposes you. I'm not very old. I'm 33 years old. Been in ministry since I was 18 years old. I've seen a lot of pastors burn out. I've seen a lot of pastors have affairs. I've seen a lot of pastors, friends of mine, get caught stealing money from the church and embezzling money because at their core belief, it's not that they hated God or hated their churches or hated their spouses. Their core belief was that they and they alone were responsible for getting their needs met and they could not trust anyone else to do it. We have to allow our core beliefs to be exposed and we have to allow our core beliefs to lie open before the presence of God. I love the way pastor and theologian Mandy Smith says this. She writes, I confess I don't believe in God. Well, if belief is cognitive assent, I guess I do believe. I assent to the idea of God. I'm willing to acknowledge God exists, but I don't believe God is present, and I don't believe God is powerful, and I don't believe God is benevolent. I don't believe God is acting right here, right now, in this place, in this body, her physical body, or in this body, the church body. If behavior attests to belief, I don't believe. It's a courageous thing to admit. And that's something that can only, that level of self-awareness always sets us up for transformation with the Holy Spirit. But it can only happen after you've been pressed hard enough and after you've experienced crisis enough. So how we respond to crisis reveals what we do and do not believe. But there's good news. The good news here is that in those crises, there's always the opportunity to be met with the tender love of God. And you almost see this trajectory in the story. Because what does Moses tell Israel while they're freaking out? Does he tell them, like, all right, guys, let's get, like, our pitchforks and shovels and hammers and let's get ready to fight the Egyptians? Does he tell them, like, let's just start swimming through the Red Sea, let's do our best? Does he tell them, no, you guys are right to freak out because I have no idea what's going on? No, Moses says to them, be still. Stand your ground and be still. The Lord will fight for you. Isn't it interesting that this story almost tells the trajectory of how we get healed from these core wounds that we have? Is when crisis comes, what's the answer? Is the answer to hustle and find solutions and quick fixes as quickly as we can? Or is the hustle to stop and be still before the creator of the universe and trust that God will fight for you? What the antidote to anxiety and fear giving us deistic amnesia is practicing stillness. Famed mathematician and theologian Blaise Pascal said, all of man's problems stem from his inability to sit in a room by himself. Charles Spurgeon taught that when crisis comes, our temptation is to thrash about like a man drowning in the ocean. And God in the story is like the lifeguard trying to pull us out of the ocean. And stillness is not an act of surrendering to the drowning. Stillness is an act of surrendering to the lifeguard. We are still, not so that we can drown more quickly, but so that we can stop flailing and be rescued. But then God says to Moses, and this part blows my mind. He says, stop crying out to me. Okay, let's stop there for a sec. I've never given a message where I was like, pray less, right? Like, that's like, and I'm not going to now. But I am saying, like, there's this interesting thing where Moses has such an awareness from this stillness in his heart. And I don't believe Moses heard a booming voice from heaven that told him to stop crying out to him. I believe Moses heard the Lord the way most of us tend to hear the Lord, which is the still small voice in our heart. Isn't it interesting that you can only, most of us, I don't want to speak for everybody. I'm sure there are some people here who can say they're always able to very clearly hear God. But for most of us, we have to cultivate stillness before we hear the voice of God. God's native tongue is a whisper. And a whisper is hard to hear and easy to ignore. And it's in the moment of stillness that we're able to cultivate an ear that can hear the voice of God. Moses had 40 years in the wilderness by himself, building a family. Between leaving Egypt and going back to Egypt, there was this character formation season of 40 years by himself, shepherding sheep, just doing the same thing day in and day out. And in that stillness, Moses cultivated an ear for what the Lord would want to say to him. And now Moses has heard from God. The one person who understood stillness is the one who gets instructions from God on how to move forward in this situation. If parting the Red Sea is the eucatastrophe of the story, the big, dramatic, unexpected twist, then what's happening in Moses is something much more quiet and much more subtle. It's not a eucatastrophe, it's more like a grace note. It's just this quiet, subtle thing that's happening in his heart. Take note, church, that rescue in the story, it does not start with the big dramatic opera of the ocean. It starts in the stillness of Moses' heart. So if you're here and you're in crisis and you're waiting for your eucatastrophe, you're waiting for that relative that you didn't know you had who died and left you $1 million, or you're waiting for God to zap your spouse's brain so they become a different person so that you can stay married to them, or you're just waiting for some unexpected, unexplainable miracle. I'm not here to tell you that miracles don't happen, but I am here to tell you that as a Pentecostal, lifelong Pentecostal here, we'll definitely never stop being a Pentecostal. We have a penchant for triumphalism and the dramatic. We tend to undervalue the stillness and the contemplative. We don't have to wait for the big dramatic moment to see that God is at work in our lives. If we can stop and we can be still, we'll notice that God is doing something. This is more of a grace note moment, God speaking to Moses' heart, than it is a eucatastrophe. And then finally, after the crisis, after the crying out, after the confusion and the doubt, after the exposing of their core beliefs, after Moses' call to stillness and him sensing what the Lord is telling him to do in this moment, Moses gets the instructions to do the unthinkable, which is take the staff in his hand and hold it over the sea and watch God part the seas. Did you know that in Scripture, the ocean is a metaphor for chaos and evil? Did you know that? You read through the book of Job and the Psalms, and they talk about Leviathan and sea monsters and all of these creatures that lurk beneath the dark surface of the ocean. In the ocean, it is a biblical image of chaos and pain and destruction. In fact, when you get to Revelation 21, you'll see this random line where it says, "And there will be no sea," as it's describing the throne room of God. And that's not just because, like, God doesn't like the beach, right? Like, he's not just saying, like, he's saying that there will be no sea, there will be no chaos, pain, and evil in this world. So what is God doing when he's separating the Red Sea, when he's parting the seas? He's not just doing a super cool magic trick. He is demonstrating to Israel, I have power over the evil and chaotic forces in this world. I have power to rescue you and deliver you. The most awful, devastating, horrifying, chaotic, disorderly thing that can happen to you will never be more powerful than the God who controls the raging seas. From the Red Sea to the cross to the resurrection to the new creation, all of it is a sign that a day is coming when chaos and pain will be a distant memory and where tears will be wiped away and love rules the land. Walter Brueggemann calls this moment, he's an Old Testament scholar, he calls this moment of the Red Sea's parting a salvation moment. He calls it a pre-baptism baptism. Egypt goes in, and death and sin is following them, and it dies in the chaotic waters. So, how do we wrap this up? I'm going to wrap this up real quick, because I am ending on time today. The first thing I want to say is that God is looking for collaborators. God didn't have to tell Moses to stretch out your hand. He didn't have to tell Moses to use your fancy stick for anything in any of these stories, right? God could have done all this by himself, but God doesn't want to do this by himself. God is looking for collaborators. Augustine has this quote that's become such a cliche, but I think it's powerful, where he says, without God, we can't, and without us, God won't. So let me ask you this, church. Who are the people around you who are in crisis and captivity that pull at your heartstrings? What pain and ache do you see in this world that you just can't stop thinking about? That when you see it on the news, or you see it on the streets, or you hear about it, it either fills you with anger or sorrow or dread or pain. What is the ache that's happening in this world that is pulling at you? And I'm here to tell you, God is looking for the collaborators. And I wonder if for some of us, the message is, stop crying out. And step into this. Step into this collaboration. Sometimes we will pray and we'll go to God and we'll ask him to move a mountain. And sometimes he'll respond by giving us a shovel and telling us to get to work. Who are the people in your life? Who are the stories in your life? What are the things happening in our culture in this season that tug at your heartstrings that you can't ignore? Step into that. I think of Chris Hahn, who plays our drums. He's on staff at our church, and the ministry he does with transient people and the services that they do. Or Josie Bean, who's a part of our church, and she works with Immigrant Connect. Like, the people in our church who are just so fired up about an issue that has just broken their heart that they can't sit on the sidelines anymore. They have to step in. I think about our volunteers who are already working full-time jobs, who will take time off work to go with James to Utah to hang out with a bunch of kids and do missions work. There's an ache in their heart that they're stepping into. And church, all of us are invited to be collaborators with God. Dallas Willard says God has chosen to work through people, not because he has to, but because he delights to. Number two. Oh, actually, I do want to say this one thing. There's a theologian named Howard Thurman. Anybody here familiar with Howard Thurman? He was Martin Luther King Jr.'s, like, hero. MLK carried Howard Thurman's books next to his Bibles everywhere he went. And Howard Thurman's consistent message throughout all of his works is that the gospel may start with a revolution of the soul, but it must always move out towards radical love for our neighbors. A lot of us come to church, and we stop at the revolution of the soul moment. We get saved. We realize, like, there's a God who loves us, who's forgiven us, who's given us purpose, and we don't allow that to move us towards radical love to our numbers. Number two, is stillness is how we take our positions. Moses says, do not be afraid, stand firm, and you'll see the deliverance the Lord brings you today. You need only be still. Stand firm literally translates to take your positions or to stand your ground. It's a military command. It's as if Moses is saying, prepare for battle. What is the battle position for God's people? It's stillness. Stillness is how we fight our battles. Stillness before the Lord. It is a contradiction of a hustle culture. It's to stop and be present to the God who is endlessly present to you. And watch as he gives you instructions. Martin Laird says, stillness is not an escape from action, but the fertile ground from which all action must spring. Number three, God rescues through you catastrophes and grace notes. He rescues through you catastrophes and grace notes. Again, a you catastrophe is a sudden and dramatic reversal when all seems lost, an unexpected breakthrough of joy and redemption. And a grace note is a quiet, subtle moment of beauty or kindness that doesn't always change the story, but it restores the heart. And God rescues through both. So if you're here and you're just waiting for the seas to part, and you haven't seen it, and you've been praying over and over again for those seas to part, I wonder if there's an invitation for you to stop and be still before your Creator and see what happens. I wrote my message too long, so we're going to wrap up. I'm going to invite the worship team to come forward, but I want to end with a story as we prepare to take communion. There was a season in my life, there was like a 2-year gap where I wasn't in ministry. It was like between youth pastor jobs. And in that 2-year gap, I worked at a halfway house for kids who were coming out of juvenile detention. So they had been sent to juvie for some pretty horrific things, and they weren't quite ready to be out, you know, in the foster care system or in public schools. And there was still a lot of work, and they were still a reasonable threat to other people their age or to families that they would be with. And so the state put them in this halfway house where we would do group counseling, and they would all live together, and they would do their meals there. And while I was working there, I met this kid. His name, I can't tell his real name, but I'll call him Jack. And Jack was somebody who came from a horrifically abusive background. And I'm not going to go into the details. Like, I did not know it was possible to inflict that much evil on a child until I met Jack. Horrifically abusive background. But Jack was in our cohort. He was in the group that I led. And he was 14 years old, and he was just like doing his best to go to do the counseling work, to do his schoolwork, to get back into the world. He had dreams of opening up a skate shop and surfing in LA and like all this stuff, like just classic 14-year-old kid. Jack had been horrifically abused by his father, and when he had told someone about it, his father was sentenced to prison. And about 3 months after I had met Jack, Jack got a phone call and told him that his father had hung himself in prison. And Jack reasoned to himself that if he had never told anyone about the abuse that was happening to him, his father would not be in prison and his father would still be alive. Jack locks himself in the bathroom of the halfway house we're working in, and we hear the mirror smash. And we try and get it. The door's locked. We can't get into it. So I grab some pliers and a hammer, and we literally bust open the doorknob, and we open it, and Jack had attempted to take his life. We called 911, and I rode with Jack in the ambulance with towels wrapped around his wrists and blood, his blood on my clothes. And we went to the emergency room, and I sat with him, and I tried to pray at this emergency room. And I tried to pray, but I just couldn't, because I just couldn't understand how God would let this happen to this kid who never asked for any of this stuff to happen to him, who has every reason in the world not to want to be around, not to believe that things are going to get better. And I just all I could say was help. It's the only word that I could get out of me because I didn't have words. Jack survives his suicide attempt. And a few months later, it's his birthday. He makes it to his 15th birthday. And he says he wants to go walking at this place called Skinner's Butte in Eugene. And it's a kind of a butte where you can see all the lights from the city. And so we take this van full of criminal youth to Skinner's Butte. We walk up the butte, and we look at the city. And at this point, like, Jack is getting straight A's. Like, he's leading the charge in group counseling. Like, there's a genuine shift in his inner dimensions. And I asked Jack, I said, man, I'm proud of you. Like, what shifted? What's going on? And I will never forget what he told me. Jack told me, he said, you know, when I got out of the hospital and our first day at art class, we were learning about mosaics and broken pieces of glass that you put together to create a piece of art. And he said, I don't know what it was, but I had a thought enter my head tell me that my life is a mosaic. And he said, I didn't even know what mosaics were before this. I don't think thoughts like that. Something from outside myself told me that my life is a mosaic and I'm going to be put back together. And he's like, you used to be a pastor. Do you think that's God? I'm like, yeah. Is that a eucatastrophe or is that a grace moment or is that both? I think it's a little bit of both. And so friends, as we gather to take communion, and if you don't have communion, I want to invite you to raise your hands and our ushers will bring them to you. If you're here and you're in crisis and you need something from God, we remember that on the cross and in the resurrection, we have the grand eucatastrophe and grace note. Whatever it is in history, I think those two things worked in tandem together. And I think if we're attentive enough to the grace notes of our lives, we'll see that God is actually working out a eucatastrophe for us. So I invite you to take the bread and hold it in your hand. And we remember that on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he broke the bread and he gave it to his disciples and he said, this is my body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And he poured the wine and he said, this is my blood poured out for you. Do this in remembrance of me.
Thanks for listening to the Red Hills Church podcast. We hope you've been challenged and inspired. Red Hills Church is located near the heart of downtown Newburgh, Oregon, and we have a dream that one day all people in our community would be fully embraced, fully transformed in Christ, following Jesus from fear to love. To experience our other messages and discover more about who we are, please visit us online at redhills.church. That's redhills.church. And again, thanks for listening.